Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to Conscious Business Radio on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. We have a major mass incarceration problem in the United States. For those of you who have relatives in prison, you probably are well aware of this, but for the rest of the country, I'm not sure if you're not close to the problem, you might not be aware of how bad this really has become. In fact, the U.S. has less than 5% of the world's population, but we have almost 25% of the world's prisoners. So our rate of incarceration is higher than all developed countries. In fact, they did a study of 222 countries, and we are the second worst in the world. In fact, we have 700 out of 100,000 people go to prison, and half of those countries only have 150 out of 100,000. We are 6 times the rate of Canada and 6 to 9 times the rate of other European countries. But this hasn't always been the case. Back in the 60s, 3 to 4 decades ago, our rate was in line with other developed countries. And in fact, they used our system as a benchmark for managing and upgrading their own systems. So within the last 3 to 4 decades, something really has happened. The good thing is that it's become a bipartisan issue that our justice system needs to be dealt with. They both know on both sides of the aisle that we really have an issue going on. Here's a quote from Newt Gingrich. He says, "There is an urgent need to address the astronomical growth in the prison population. With its huge costs in dollars and lost human potential, the criminal justice system is broken, and the conservatives must lead the way in fixing it." The Democrats are also, they're also aligned in this, and here is another quote. "We believe Congress has a critical role to play in helping to restore trust in the criminal justice system, ensuring that every American is treated equally before the law." That's from Democrats Elijah Cummings, Conyers, and Thompson, and they're raking Democratic members on 3 powerful House committees. So it's becoming a bipartisan thing to address this major, major issue. And what we have going on today is I have Lois Ahern's coming, and she's the founder of the Real Cost of Prisons Project, and she's been looking into this issue for over 50 years, and she works with activists and justice policy researchers and people directly experiencing the impacts of mass incarceration, and she's really working hard to bring meaningful reform to the system. And we deal with a lot of the issue. We talk about a lot of the issues, and we talk about the main contributing factors to the explosion of growth. We talk about the institutional bias towards wealth, the policies and prejudices that increases the incarceration rate amongst minority communities. We also talk about the broken justice system and how they put prisoners in jail. So that's what the topic of today's interview is about. And I am going to welcome Lois Ahern's to the program. Hi, Lois. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you for joining us. You have so much experience in this area, and I think it's an important topic to talk about. I first want to jump into the magnitude of how many people we have in our prisons and jails here in the United States, and I'm going to start with a quote that Hillary Clinton recently did. She said, "It's a stark fact that the United States has less than 5% of the world's population, yet we have almost 25% of the world's total prison population. The numbers today are much higher than they were 30, 40 years ago, despite the fact that crime is at historic lows. In fact, out of 222 countries, we were the second highest out of 222 countries that were tracked by the Institute for Criminal Policy Research. And we had 700 per 100,000 people incarcerated, but a lot of those countries had, over half of them only had 150 per 100,000. So we are not just double, we are like 6 times more people than a lot of countries. and 6 to 9 times more than a lot of the Western European countries. But decades ago, this wasn't the case. We were more on track with them. Why do you think this has happened here in the United States?
Before even getting into why, I just want to go through some of the numbers again, because there are 2.3 million people that are caged in prisons and jails in the United States. So those are the people that are locked up. So that's a huge number, as you said, like way out of whack with Western European countries and other countries. But in addition to that 2.3 million people that are locked up, there are another 5 million more who are under correctional control, which means that they're on probation or parole. So that's 7.3 million U.S. citizens are under correctional control at any given day. So, I mean, the numbers are actually even higher in terms of who is controlled by the criminal justice system.
It's almost like 5% of adult males, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it's a huge number. And the other number that I just want to throw out there for people to try to wrap their heads around is that there are 2.7 million children who have an incarcerated parent, one in every 28 kids.
Yeah, that's where it really gets.
Yeah. So that's a lot of kids. And so when we think about, or when I think about, the number of people that are impacted by this system, it's not only 2.3 million, it's not only 5 million more, it's all of those kids. And then if you think that all of those people that are locked up also have mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and loved ones, the reach of it and the impact of it into mostly communities of color and poor communities who have been mostly impacted by this is huge. So it's a very big set of numbers, such a big set of numbers that I think a lot of times people can't even, you know, get a grasp of how many people that really is. The one other thing I want to say, just in terms of numbers before we start, well, you said it's 25% of the world's population of incarcerated people are in the United States, but of that number, there's actually 33% of the world's population are women that are incarcerated in the United States. So there are even more women than that's a growing number compared to how many women are locked up around the world. Yeah. We incarcerate many, many, many more women, not just men, but more women, mostly for very low-level offenses.
Well, if we have less than 5% of the world's population, but 33% of the world's population of women in prison.
Yes, women.
There's just something wrong.
There's something wrong there, right?
It's out of whack.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I would say that there's definitely something wrong. So, I mean, a lot of things wrong. You can't have this happen and not have a lot of things wrong. And so I think it's
not just, you know, people say that it's because of privatization, but when you look at privatization, it really isn't.
No.
That's not because the whole industry is, well, it's larger if you look at other variables, but $74 billion business, but the privatization is only about 10% of that currently.
Right. I mean, let me get back to the privatization thing and answer your first question about why I think this has happened in the United States, because I think we should, you know, start.
Yes.
So, I mean, you're right that in the 1960s, the United States had a similar amount of people incarcerated proportionately to the rest of the world. So from the early 1900s through the 1960s, in the United States, the total number of people that were incarcerated was 250,000 people. And so that proportionally was similar to the rest of, you know, like Western European countries.
Sure.
And so for all those years, it was basically the same. That 250,000 people, that's how many women are locked up right now. Yeah, so you can see, I mean, see the growth. So starting in the 60s, in my opinion, in my view, what happened was a lot of the kind of policing and a lot of the kind of sentencing that we've gotten into, these very long, very punitive sentences, which is the opposite from the direction of European countries. In my opinion, that started in response, in direct response. And you can read quotes from Richard Nixon that actually say this. We have to do, quote, we have to do something about the blacks, he said. And so a lot of these responses, which resulted in mass incarceration, to me are a response to the civil rights movement and the gains of the civil rights movement in terms of, for example, access to the vote. So if you look at a lot of those struggles were for voting rights, but now, because of the kinds of laws that were passed in the interim, you have a state like Florida that, despite the civil rights movement, 1.5 million people are disenfranchised in Florida. 1.5 million
people. Well, so much of this is the trigger for a lot of the civil unrest that we have going on in this country right now. I mean, this is part of it. I see it as a big part of it. There's a lot of other factors when it comes, you know, the banking and the economy and all these things, but this is another big underlying factor.
And I'm not sure what you mean by that. I mean, you mean that people's frustration with the criminal justice system?
Yes.
And policing?
Yes.
Yes, I agree. I agree. It's the criminal justice system, how it's not working for people, policing that it's very, very extreme, especially in certain communities. And we know which communities those are African American communities. I think it is a response to that, and also a response to the kinds of fines and fees that people get, driving with taillight, and those get compounded by interest, and then somebody has a warrant out for their arrest, and then they get arrested because of basically a broken taillight and fees that they can't pay, and then they end up getting put in jail.
How much of that is
they're stuck in jail, and then once they're stuck in jail, any problems that they had on the outside are compounded because they're sitting in jail and can't deal with those problems. So, I mean, I think so. It's this combination of policing, of fees, of then those fees being turned over to collection agencies, or people ending up getting warrants for their arrest for something that would be a minor infraction. It's very common. I mean, if you look at the unrest that was in Ferguson, if you read, there's just recently this incredibly damning report of Baltimore and policing in Baltimore, which led to all of the civil unrest after the Freddie Gray murder.
Well, the problem is, the sad part is, it's not the police. They're the representation of a much bigger system and a much bigger problem.
Right. It might not be individual police. I'm not saying an individual.
No, well, even the police officers on the street aren't. They represent a much bigger, to the people, they represent a much bigger system. The whole justice system.
Yes, they're law enforcement.
Yeah.
They are the state.
They are the face of
the
state.
They are the state on the street.
Even though they are individual employees doing their job.
Right, but once they put on the uniform, they're not an individual. Once they put on the uniform, they are wearing just somebody wearing an army uniform.
People, that's what they represent. But the poor, there are people, police officers are individuals working a job to pay their mortgage and to make a living for their family. However, to the average person on the street, they represent the state.
They do represent the state.
Yes.
I mean, it's not. They are the state. I mean, so they
no,
actually
they,
are.
They, well, no, they can,
they're,
because they're
empowered there's
more
to have guns. They're empowered to
sure,
arrest
people.
Sure, but
there's more to it. There's the court system. There's
right,
the Congress.
Afterwards, but they're the first face.
Sure,
they're the first
that's
face.
What I'm saying.
They're
the face of a much bigger system behind it, which
absolutely
is the justice system, which is, you know, there's a lot of people that make decisions in this country. The police don't get to make very many systems. They act out what decisions are made by others.
I agree. Yes. I agree. I mean, there are, I mean, I just have to say, I mean, I agree in theory. In practice, though, we see that there are all the time individual actors.
Sure.
That are
I'm
acting
sure.
outside what the confines of the rules that they should be acting on.
Well,
and
there's people who are going to act out in no matter what environment and break, go over the lines and do things, and it's
yes,
just not.
Only in this instance, they're doing it dressed as an arm of the state.
Sure.
So it's different than an individual acting in that way. These are individuals acting theoretically, and when people see it, they're not saying, oh, this is an individual. They're saying, this is someone acting in this way on behalf of the state.
So why has this happened? It started in the 70s.
We don't want to go down that path because that's all we'll talk about. So
it really is a different issue because it's trying to control how they behave and do their things and everything else. And I don't want to get into that topic.
Right.
But
and
the
I,
topic I, of too many, you know, so many people in prison is a much bigger society issue
absolutely.
That we need to be looking at. Yes.
I'm with you. So, I mean, to me, there are various things that, I mean, as I said, I think that a lot of the kind of laws and policing and the system that we have now was started in response to the civil rights movement and started in response to the kind of civic disturbances that we had in the 60s. And so I think that led to the kind of policing that we have, the war on drugs, which basically...
wasn't that a response to the kind of the hippie movement too? The young kids
I don't
all
think so, because
using drugs?
The hippies are not the people that were policed. And they aren't the people that were policed. And I mean, I live in a community that has 5 colleges in it.
Right? Well, no, but I mean the drug
and
use
those
went
colleges,
way up during that time.
Those
in the
colleges
60s.
Where there's a lot of pot smoking are not policed. They are not police.
Yeah.
I mean, they each have their local, you know, their school police force, but they are not police. Whereas where I live about 20 miles south of where I live is a community, an African-American community. And there is the same, I mean, there's no difference. There's not been any study that's found a difference in the use of drugs between blacks, whites, and Latinos. But yet, certain communities are policed and focused on in a way that other communities are not. So I can see what's going on down the block from me at this college, and I can see what's going on down the road from me in an African-American community and how the intensity of that. So the war on drugs was not started... the focus of the war on drugs, people are not locked up for pot. The focus of the war on drugs has been African American communities. That is where it has happened. And along with the kind of policing that I'm talking about, the other thing that's happened is in the courts is we started having mandatory minimum sentences for drugs. And so it took away the discretionary power of judges. It gave a lot more power to district attorneys, which I can talk about more later. And so people were ending up getting much higher sentences than they were before these laws were put into place. And
well,
so,
Rockefeller in New York made mm-hmm. it mandatory, even if you had 4 ounces of marijuana in possession, to get a 15-year sentence.
Right. Now, those laws have been overturned in New York.
But that started it.
Right. That was part of it. But the other thing that was part of it that was much more detrimental than pot was the sentencing for crack versus powder cocaine. And so there was 100 times higher. You had the same sentence for if you had a tiny, tiny amount of crack and 100 times the amount of that, of powder cocaine, you got the same sentence.
Why was that?
Why was that? Because the mythology of the time was that crack was somehow much more dangerous and much, much more pernicious than powder cocaine, even though they're exactly the same thing. There's powder cocaine, and then there's crack cocaine, cocaine with baking soda and water.
That's awful.
And yet that became the penalty. And so you had people, so in the white communities, they were using powder cocaine during, you know, the height of the use of these drugs.
Sure.
I mean, those, and in the black communities, they were using crack cocaine. So people were being sentenced for extraordinarily long sentences for basically the same exact crime based on these laws that were passed that became mandatory drug sentencing
laws.
Well,
here are some numbers. The census data from 2010 showed that whites make up 64% of the overall population, but just 39% of the prison population, whereas blacks are 13% of the population and make up 40% of the prison population. So in prison, they're about the same, but blacks were only 13% of the population compared to 64% of the whites.
Right. And in my state, which is the state of Massachusetts, more than 70% of the people that get mandatory sentences, that is much longer sentences, right, that involve no judicial discretion, are African Americans, even though there's about 8% of the population of Massachusetts is African American.
So 8% of the population, but yet 70% of them get that sentence.
Mandatory minimum sentences for drugs. And so that means that people stay in prison a lot longer.
Now, are they committing more crimes, or is it about the same?
I think in terms of drug use, in terms of drug sales, all of that is about this, if we're talking about drugs, is about the same. And yet, because of access to lawyers, because of the plea bargaining situation, because of racism in the system.
Well, 90%, here's another stat. I want to talk about plea bargaining because this is a really big issue.
Yeah.
90% of the convictions are a result of plea bargains where people plead guilty to a lesser offense, perhaps a different category, one that may not have actually committed. Oftentimes, serious offenses are ignored to save money and secure a guilty verdict. After accounting for cases dismissed for error, only 3% of federal cases even go to trial. And here's a quote from Judge Rakoff is his name.
He's a federal
Rakoff. You probably know him well, from District of New York. The criminal justice system in the United States, this is what he was saying, the criminal justice system in the United States today bears little relationship to what the founding fathers contemplated, what the movies and television portray, or what the average American believes. So basically what the average person believes. And I got to tell you, before I started doing all this research, I didn't realize the extent of what this was.
Yeah.
He goes on to say, the Supreme Court's suggestion that a plea bargain is a fair and voluntary contractual agreement between two relatively equal parties is a total myth. It is much more like a contract of adhesion in which one party can effectively force its will on another party. He's saying that basically the prosecutor just scares the hell out of these people into doing a plea bargain that's not in their best interest.
Exactly. And the way that the prosecutor scares people is by saying, let's say there's one crime, right? Whatever that crime is, let's say somebody rob somebody, right? That each tiny fraction of an action of that one thing that we would look at and say this is a crime could result in 20 different charges being brought, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the prosecutor says to the person that committed that crime or is charged with committing that crime, says, I can charge you with 20 of these offenses, and he'll list or she'll list all of those things. And each one of those could bring a sentence of a year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever, right? Adding up to a very, very big, long amount of time.
50 years or
something. In a state prison, or 20 years in a state prison, right? Or I have a deal for you, right? I will charge you with these two offenses. All you have to do is take this plea. And instead of getting going to trial and maybe getting 20 years for all of these offenses, convictions, you just take the plea and you'll get 2.5 years. So the person doesn't, most likely, the person doesn't have a good defense lawyer, because what do you need for a good defense lawyer?
You need money.
That's right. You need money. And so the person doesn't, if they had money, they wouldn't be robbing the 7-Eleven. You know, I mean, people with money do not rob the 7-Eleven. So if you, so they don't have access. They have access to, a criminal defense lawyer for the indigent. And most people who are charged with crimes are indigent. So they might meet with a lawyer, you know, a couple of times, and the lawyer says, just take the plea. You'll be better off taking the plea. And so, without good counsel, without anything, the person, you know, it's like the expression is, meet 'em and plea 'em. And so that's the way, you know, if you have a criminal defense lawyer who has, instead of 25 cases or 30 cases a year, right? If you have a public defender, might have 500 cases a year.
Oh my God. They just don't have time to do it anyways.
They don't have time to do anything.
Well, how?
You know, they have time to open the folder, meet the person, and try to make some kind of split-second decision that's going to affect that person's life.
It's the McDonald's drive-through of defense.
Yes, exactly. And prosecutors know that. Prosecutors' offices, DA's offices, they're fully funded. You know, they're fully funded. But public defenders, I mean, in some states, I think it was the state of Louisiana, the way that public defenders' offices are being funded is from these fees that people have to pay for basically being arrested. And so, I mean, the whole system is so corrupted and so leans in favor of either people with money or parts of the government that do have money, like, for example, the police and prosecutors. So it's become in so many ways, we can talk about privatization and all of that, but it's in so many ways a system that's based on money, whether you have money or whether you don't have money. And if you don't have money, then you are, your chances of succeeding are so much less. So when you walk into a jail, who do you see? You know, you see a lot of black people, or you see a lot of Latino people, because for all of these reasons that we know historically, you know, starting with slavery and going up until now, that people who are African American have been severely disadvantaged by racism, by lack of money being put into education or job training or substance abuse or all of the things that we know can actually improve the situation, not just for people who are charged with crimes, but all people.
Well, all people, because it does affect blacks. Are, like we said, I looked at the numbers. Blacks are out of whack percentage wise and extremely out of whack. But there are white people that are in there too, suffering
absolutely
the same situation.
Poor white people, absolutely.
Yes.
The bottom line here is the word poor.
It's
that is
class system poor. Situation.
It is hugely a class system. I mean, it's also a system that has racism embedded in it, but it's that interaction between class and race that drives the system.
Well,
and
I have some questions about young people, teenagers. Sometimes, you know, I've heard stories of teenagers being caught in a process where they're just kind of swept up with the older gang members.
Yeah.
They happen to be there when a crime occurs.
Yeah.
They get swept up and they have to do a next thing you know, this teenager who happens to be with their older brother really hasn't done anything
yeah.
their whole life is now in prison for 10 years.
Absolutely. And I mean, that is absolutely the case. I mean, so a lot of times young people, they're young. Right?
Well,
they're
yeah, 14,
teenagers.
15, they just need their parents.
Yes, they're not people that are making clear decisions like, you know, any 14, 15, 16-year-old, especially boys, are. You know, so they can be easily influenced. And so they do. They end up getting charged in the same crime. They end up often depending on the state or how the prosecution brings the charges. Instead of getting charged as juveniles and ending up in the juvenile system, they get charged as adults.
Why do they do that when the kid doesn't have any record and he just happens to be in the car
you tell
with
me.
His older brother?
You tell me.
Hmm.
I mean, really, it is. I mean, prosecutors can become, you know, the prosecution and the jury at the same time. Just by how the charges are brought, just by the kinds of plea bargains that are extracted, it's up to the prosecutor to decide what to do and what not to do, how to charge somebody. They have a huge amount of power, and that is one of the key reasons, I believe, that and the fact that it's this money-based system.
Well, talking about money, 100% of the prisoners are expected to work while they're in prison.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can see you can gain skills, you can gain self-esteem. If you're just sitting there, you don't feel as good about yourself compared to if you're working, especially if you're gaining skills. However,
we just have to say that most jobs in prison, people are not, if you go into a prison, one of the first things you'll notice is how shiny the floors are.
Well, some of the jobs might be that, but
but
you have to admit that doing something is better than nothing, and
I agree.
It does help your self-esteem. However, the prisoners are paid for doing work, 10 cents to 40 cents an hour. And my understanding is that they're expected to use this money to buy their basic needs.
Yes.
From stuff like, their toothpaste to clothes, their shoes. But they're charged a price on these basic things that are much higher than what we pay out in the real world.
Yeah, it could be like 10 times. Like, I periodically buy food for somebody I know who's in prison. And so I get sent this list. He's in North Carolina. So I get sent this list of what it is that I can purchase for him. And I can purchase like the most minute little jar of instant coffee that you can possibly envision, you know? I mean, like something that's smaller than the smallest little small thing on a shelf in your supermarket, like half the size of the smallest thing. And that will be $4.
Oh, geez.
If I want to buy, a tiny little bag of peanuts, right? Just like much smaller than what you could get in a 7-Eleven. I mean, much, much smaller. That's $1.50. So when you look, and so that's true about food. It's true about if somebody needs a pair of sweatpants or another T-shirt, or a better pair of shoes than some shoes like that are like those little sort of Chinese little slipper kind of things. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
I mean, if you want to get anything like that, the kinds of things that people just need to survive because the food, I mean, the quality of food, I mean, when I say food, I have to put food in quotes. because it's barely even food. I mean, it's basically carbohydrates and fat and sugar. Right.
Just
that's
what
it
they
is.
Need.
Yes, that's what they. That's what
you
they
know.
Get.
I think a lot of people don't feel bad because they're prisoners anyways. You know, they committed a crime
yeah.
and whatever. But when you start digging into this, and I got to tell you, there are people that should be in there and they're bad guys and we don't want them on the street. And that's there's and every country has them and you're always going to have it for the rest of the time. However, when you look at our system, there's some pretty messed up stuff where there's like we're talking about the teenagers that are in there or the
yes.
fact that.
And the thing is that. When you think people who are getting 10 cents an hour and they're not working 40 hours because they're not 40 hours worth of work, right? And then if they have like a disciplinary charge in some prison systems, then they get like a fine, an actual money fine. So if they make any money, the money comes out of that for that fine. So who pays for these things that people who are locked up need?
Well,
it's not the people that are locked up. It's their families.
Oh, yeah.
Their families pay for them. So, for example...
Well, how about medical needs? Like, if they
yes,
have...
Yes, but let me just say, so it's women make up 80% of the family members who are primarily responsible for covering the costs of their family member in prison. And just like the people who are locked up don't have money... Most of the people who are their families don't have money. Or if they had money, they would have gotten them a good lawyer.
Well, yeah, they probably wouldn't be in there.
That's right. So that burden for telephone calls, for medical care, for food, for clothing, for all of the things that somebody needs to survive is not somebody who's committed a crime.
Well, now...
They're not... The people who are doing it, who are having to pay for it, are not
Do they
criminals.
Rack up their debt, or do they just not get it?
They don't get it.
Even medical care?
If there's a $5 copay, then that comes out of whatever it is that they earn. But
they're
people
10 to 40
often,
cents
but
an
people,
hour.
But people often don't, I mean, just like I said, I have to put the word food in quotes when it comes to prisons. You have to put the word medical care in quotes because people wait for years to get a tooth pulled, not fixed, but pulled. I know someone who had, you know, these uterine tumors a young woman. She had to wait till she got out of prison, and they were growing and growing and growing the whole time she was in prison. Mm. So she basically wasn't in prison long enough to actually get the medical care that she needed. So people have, there are hundreds and hundreds, thousands. I mean, I've personally heard hundreds of stories where people have cancer and terrible pain, and they don't get treated, and their treatment is Tylenol.
And they just die. So the Federal Communications Commission recently set a cap on 25 cents per minute phone calls. It's a $1.2 billion industry just collecting on the phone calls. Who pays for that?
The families pay for it,
but who gets that money and where does that money go?
It's split. It's split between the company and the company has with either the state prison system or the federal prison system, or the jail. And so everybody, so for jails especially, they get a much higher kickback from every call. So the jails make money on every call.
Well, now, the people are getting paid between 10 and 40 cents an hour, and a lot of work, from what I understand, is being done for corporations around our country.
There's some work. I think that has been... overblown. I mean, everybody has to work if there's a job, and everybody gets paid terrible, terrible amounts of money. I mean, basically from nothing to maybe a dollar at the outside limit. I think in the federal system, it's up to $2 for UniCorps, which is this federal work system. The thing about it is that everybody, there still is, people are trapped in this kind of system.
So they're making up work for people because they don't have work for them.
Well, they're maybe not making up work. I would say this constant cleaning and buffing of floors, which, you know,
well,
is
making up. What about corporations having them do basic stuff for them? That's not true. That doesn't happen
yes,
very
no,
much.
It is true, but there are some corporations, that do use prison labor. Unicor, which is a federal prison company, corporation within the federal prison system, that's the biggest system. And so people in the federal system work in that system, and they make, you know, probably if you're in a school and you're sitting at one of those big enormous desks, you know, those big metal desks.
That's
probably a Unicor product. And so people work in that system. People work in Framingham Prison, which is in Massachusetts, a women's prison. Those women prisoners make flags.
Okay.
Some prisoners make mattresses.
And now, where does that money go to?
Those are things that are produced for the flags. I don't know who they're making the flags for, but the mattresses, those could be bought by the universities that need a ton of mattresses, you know, not great mattresses for every dorm room.
Well, now if they did it right, it could be more of a win-win situation, but are they doing it in a way
that's... it's very hard for them to do it right because, whatever right is, one, it would have to be up to someone's free will about whether they wanted to do it or not. They would have to be paid according to a standard wage. A lot of corporations on the outside, because they're being paid, people are being paid so much less, feel like it's unfair competition. So,
there's a lot of issues around that.
Yeah, and the other thing about people working in prisons is that they are, they have to be, let's say if you're a prisoner, you have to be counted 5 times a day, right?
Yeah.
So you have to be someplace where everybody knows you're going to be counted. You have there. It's so extremely regulated in terms of what people have access to, what kind of tools people have access to, you know, what kind of ability to move around a floor with a whole group of other people. All of those kinds of things that are endemic to prisons and to being controlled in a prison situation are not exactly the right environment for being productive in a factory, for being
sure.
productive. So, just the whole nature of prisons themselves and the kind of control that prisons exercise over prisoners means that those are odd work environments. And so it's one of the things that has kept, private companies or even not private companies like a prison that is manufacturing something for the prison's use, like clothes, from being really productive.
Well, with this being such a massive problem in our country, it's really becoming obvious to politicians, and they're talking. People are starting to talk about it.
Yeah.
What are we doing? Are you seeing anything actually being done, or are you seeing just a lot of talk?
I'm seeing a lot of talk. But I have to say, having done this for many years, it used to be there was no talk.
Right? So there's a beginning of the conversation is going
it,
on.
It, the conversation is the fact that, I don't think Trump has mentioned anything about it, but on the Democratic side, during the primary, each of the candidates actually spoke about the criminal legal system and mass incarceration. They used the words mass incarceration. 4 years ago, nobody even said a peep about any of this.
Well, I
nobody.
Think it's embarrassing for our country. How can it we should, not be embarrassed about this?
It should be. I don't know if it is. Or
they,
if it
they
isn't,
should be.
It,
we should,
it should
be embarrassed.
I mean, it's a human
this.
Rights issue. It's a human. I mean, if the United States is going to talk
a mess.
About.
Let's say they all belong in jail. Let's just say they all belong in prison. Then we're a flipping mess. So right, we should be embarrassed one way or the other. We're either a complete mess or there's a human right or something in between. But either way, it should be embarrassing.
Yes, it should be embarrassing. And hopefully it is. But I think the first step for change of anything is increased awareness, increased education. For someone who has no contact with the criminal legal system or with incarceration, people have to begin to see that this is something that isn't just impacting the people who are locked up and their families, that it actually has an impact on them as well.
It has an impact on our whole society because it's affecting our streets, it's affecting our ability as corporations to have solid workers. It's affecting a lot of things.
That's right.
But
and the more people see that, the more there will be a demand for change. And I think that's the thing that we're starting to see is you're interviewing me, right? Am I the first person you interviewed on this subject?
On this topic, yes. It's a big topic. I thought, gosh, I should really, if we have 25% of the population of people in prison, this is a really big issue I need to be talking about.
Exactly. So you've made that decision that it's important, whereas in the past, it wasn't even part of your conversation. Now that we've had the conversation, every time you see something, every time you see a show, you know, like Law and Order or whatever these, you know, the trial court shows are, you know, show the great defense lawyer and the prosecution, you'll think, oh, plea bargains. You know, these are ones that didn't have to take the plea.
Those are one of the 3%.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, every piece of information that anybody gathers makes them more skeptical or more questioning about what it is that they're seeing. I mean, in the United States, the crime rate now is the same crime rate that it was in the 60s, a very low crime rate, the lowest since the 60s. And yet the rate of the number of people that are incarcerated is huge.
Well, we look like with the number of people incarcerated, we look like we're a mess. Like there's we have people on the street we're just going crazy. It's no place is safe. Everybody's committing crimes.
But it's not about that because in reality, if you were to watch the news, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. You know, if you were to watch the news, you'd think, yeah, everything is going crazy. But what I'm saying is the crime rate is at a 50-year low.
Oh, it's the lowest it's been.
What's going crazy is the incarceration rate.
It's out of whack.
So that there isn't a relationship between the crime rate and the incarceration rate, and there never has been. What drives the incarceration rate has to do with politics, has to do with fear, has to do with racism, has to do with policing, has to do with access to money or not access to money. Those are the things that drive the amount of incarceration that we have, not crime. If you look at any graph, I mean, you can Google it, rate of incarceration and rate of crime, and see what that graph looks like. Those numbers never come together.
Yeah, they should have the same curve.
Yes, they should theoretically have the same curve.
So what does your organization do, and how can people learn more about your organization and the issue?
Okay. Well, my organization, it's a national organization. I do a lot of work on ending money bail, because that is what a lack of access to money and bail really puts way more people. Most people in most jails, 50 to 60% of the jails are filled with people that just are too poor to make bail.
Sure.
So people are always saying, oh, we need more jails because the jails are overcrowded. My statement is, well, if we got rid of money bail, which states have gotten rid of money bail, certain states have gotten rid of money bail, then we wouldn't need new jails.
Well, because a lot of those people are, I mean, you should be innocent
They are innocent.
Innocent until proven guilty.
Exactly.
But they just, when there's somebody,
they just can't make bail.
But when someone's a run risk, then you have to figure something out.
Right, but they have to be able to assess whether that person is. And this isn't about assessing that. This is just purely, do you have the money or you don't have the money?
So
yes
you,
or no?
So I do
work on that. I try to stop new jails, and I work to end money bail. I do work on conditions of confinement, like solitary, but also conditions of confinement, like horrendous food or lack of access to health care. And I also work on putting forward alternatives to incarceration so that people can be diverted, never go to jail. That if they're charged with something, depending on what the charge is, most especially a nonviolent offense, that there can be other kinds of conditions that allow people to resolve what happened and stay out of jail and not end up with all of the horrible, horrible consequences of being in jail. So those are the kinds of areas that I concentrate a lot in.
And where can they get more information? Your website has a lot of articles and a lot of information.
Yeah, it has a ton of information.
And I can put that up on the radio page, but why don't you tell people what it is right now?
Okay, so there's the Real Cost of Prisons Project has a website, and it's www.realcostofprisons.org. And if you go to that website, there is a wealth of information. I mean, all kinds of research, all kinds of links to other organizations, bibliographies, movies that you can see. It also has a lot of political writing from people who are incarcerated that talk about the situation from the point of view of the incarcerated person. And so there's all of that material is up on the website, along with links to as many, many, many hundreds of other organizations. And there's also a link on the Real Cost of Prisons Project Facebook page, website, a link to our Facebook page. There are about 30,000 people on that Facebook page. And every day I post things about news, organizing, what's happening around the country in terms of the biggest, sort of like the biggest arch about all of these different things that we just touched on. So those are that big range of things is what I post about. And so if people are on Facebook, they can just like that page. It's a public page, and then they'll get this information and they can, you know, decide what they want to do with it. Hopefully, the first step is people becoming aware of it, and then in every community now, there is work being done to try to change the system for the better.
I think the more people that know, the more it can get changed. Well, I appreciate so much you coming on and sharing this with us, and I will have this information on the radio page so people can go there and learn more. So thank you so much, and I hope you have a great day today.
Great. Thanks for inviting me.
No problem.
Bye-bye.
That's all we have for the interview today. I hope you got something out of this. I did this interview last summer. Actually, yeah, last summer by now. It was a while ago. Situation's the same, obviously, as it was 8 months ago. I've learned stuff since then. I've been covering this issue. It's become kind of a passionate issue for me. And I have learned how much it's breaking down our communities. I've learned a little bit more and studied a little bit more on this. I recommend that if you are not close to this, take some time to look into it, because I think from a distance, it looks like we're just being tough on crime. But when you start digging into it, you're like, oh, there's some serious abuse of justice and things here going on, instead of it just being cracking down on crime, which I think most of us, you know, cracking down on crime and cleaning up our streets sounds like a really good deal. And it is, if that's all you're doing. But if you're doing it at the expense of lots and lots of people being denied justice and hurting families and communities, then we need to rethink it, because it's not quite what we had in mind. And I really recommend that you look into this issue more if you're on the fence and thinking this is all a bunch of hogwash. So now I want to close out the show again by having a tribute to all the people that have fallen around the world from all the ridiculous wars that we keep having endless fighting. I don't know why we can't come to some agreements and stop, just stop killing each other. So here we go, the tribute to all the fallen around the world.